Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Welcome to Dialect Radio. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 up there in Preston, and also to listeners of Unity FM 93.5 in the Midlands up in Birmingham. I understand you can also check us out on YouTube, thanks to modern technology. If you put Dialect 140910, you'll be able to find a little YouTube video of Dialect Radio on there. I understand it's a work in progress, so the quality will improve over the coming weeks. Hurrah! Our theme this week on Dialect is women, with some of our reports this week focusing on the work of some fantastic women local to Bristol and also a bit further afield. Our guest this evening is Judith Brown, and she's here to discuss a convoy to Gaza. She's also a member of the Bristol Gaza Link. Features this week are by Michaela Dennis, Alex Mill and Tony Gosling. As usual, Malcolm Greaves reads another chapter from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. Tim Burrows reads us one of his poems. No Jeff Sparks this week, but as organised as ever, he's provided us with a What Song Guide and a Song of the Week in his absence. So, to start off our women-centred show, let's hear from the Beatles with Lady Madonna. Of course, that was the Beatles there, and that was Lady Madonna from a long time ago. And coming up in the show a little bit later on...
I'm the Speaker of the House of Lords.
But first, joining me in the studio is Judith Brown from the Bristol Gaza Link. Hello.
Hello.
So tell me, how long is your involvement in the Bristol Gaza Link?
I became the Vice Chairman at the AGM last year, which is just over a year ago. And during the time that I've been involved with the Bristol Gaza Link, they've been very busy. They've been part of a convoy to Gaza, and they've also been on a flotilla to Gaza. And now they're organising another convoy. It's actually their third convoy that they've sent to Gaza, because they did one just after the first bombardment of Gaza in 2009.
So tell me about the latest convoy to Gaza mission. When is it going to take place? Where are you going?
Well, we're leaving Bristol on the 10th of October, the 10th of the 10th of the 10th.
Yeah.
And we're going overland to Libya. Well, not completely overland, of course. We'll have to catch a ferry. But we're going across the channel. We're going through France, and then we're catching a ferry to Libya. Then we're driving from Libya through Egypt and entering Gaza at the Rafah crossing.
Okay. So where do you sort of expect the trouble to occur? you think, on much earlier than that?
Well, we're hoping that it will be fairly smooth, although the difficulty is that it's always unpredictable, and the unpredictable leg really is the Egyptian section, where from time to time people have had a lot of problems in Egypt. I think that there is a lot of political problems in Egypt in general, and they're obviously very worried about people not following the line of the government on Gaza and Palestine.
I understand that on the border, I mean, they've erected, if that's the word, 25-foot deep sort of steel sheets to block off all the tunnels that are going into
It takes them 4 days to dig through a tunnel through the steel sheet to dig a new tunnel.
Will it sort of be like an official way that you'll get through to Gaza?
Because this year, in fact, after the flotilla was attacked, Egypt opened the Rafah crossing, and it's been open since then, and there's been several aid convoys going through Rafah. I think that this is the fourth convoy that will have left from Libya this year, and also they've, for example, there's a Syrian convoy going in today, which is a ship has gone from Syria to a port in Egypt. And there's been other convoys as well from Europe and also a flotilla from Ireland.
Have you been on a convoy yourself before?
No, I haven't. This is a new and exciting adventure for me.
Okay, so were you tempted before and didn't and may have been?
I've always thought that it would be something that I would quite like to do. First of all, there's the humanitarian mission and the feeling that, you know, there's this illegal blockade and the people are suffering in Gaza. And before, I've been an aid worker in developing countries for many years, and I've seen that women and children always suffer disproportionately. And today you're talking about women's issues, and I'm sure that in Gaza it's the women and children that suffer disproportionately. If your home's been knocked down and you've got a newborn baby, you're trying to get the clothes washed, the nappies changed, children trying to do homework when they haven't got a table, and there's no security. Your children might be frightened, wetting the beds, and you can't wash the clothes and things like that. So I just feel that this is a very difficult situation for women and children. So part of the mission is obviously humanitarian, but I think it's also, in a sense, turned into a political mission in itself, in as much as the only end to the problem for the ordinary people of Gaza is to lift this blockade, which actually is illegal.
Which kind of leads me on to the support that you have received, say, from Libya and Turkey, and you'll receive from Libya and again, I mean, obviously there is an element of politicism in that, an anti-Israeli sentiment. Do you sort of try to just sort of ignore the politics of it and just sort of accept it and sort of blind faith?
I wouldn't say yes to either of those issues. I think that being pro-Palestinian isn't necessarily anti-Israeli, and I think that a lot of Arab countries would in fact like to have good relationships with Israel, and the thing that blocks them from doing it is Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. And so I think that it could be a win-win situation if peace could come in that troubled parts of the world, but of course that's very elusive, and lots of people have tried.
Does the Bristol's Gaza Link sort of have a line on what it would like to see, sort of, for example, a two-state solution or anything?
I think that probably what most people think is that they think it's an issue for Israelis and Palestinians, and we just want peace and we want everyone to live together in harmony, because not only will it benefit Israel and Palestine, but it'll benefit everyone in the Western world, including, of course, all of the people of Bristol. You know, a peaceful world is a better world for us to share.
There was an agreement by the Israelis to sort of freeze building the settlements, and that ceasefire, if you like, has now ended. So what do you think the atmosphere might be like when you go along and, you know...
Well, because there's no settlements in Gaza anymore. They've all been evacuated. But I think that the settlement building has gone on, you know, since 1967. Nothing's changed. There's been lots of UN resolutions saying that they're illegal and it shouldn't happen. Because since then, the wall's been built. The International Court of Justice has ruled it illegal and has told Israel it must pull it down because it's built on Palestinian land. It hasn't happened. And so I think that it's just one more thing going on. It might, of course, impede the peace talks, but then a lot of people who are in positions of power don't feel that the peace talks are going to achieve very much anyway. But I think what probably ordinary people aren't aware of is when you talk about settlement building, of course, you have to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from their land in order to build the settlement of the colonial powers. And that word, ethnic cleansing, is the one that seems to not reach the British public.
Does everybody agree that it's ethnic cleansing? Well, otherwise, perhaps we would hear that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, there's a very famous Israeli academic called Ilan Pape. He was a lecturer in Israel. He's now at Exeter in UK, a professor of history, and he's well documented ethnic cleansing and actually directly calls it ethnic cleansing. But other people, like, for example, the Israeli historian who's to the right perspective, Benny Morris, he's also talked about it in those sorts of terms. And actually, his only criticism, because it was that Palestinians haven't been ethnically cleansed enough, and, you know, you've had a pattern of doing it, and it ought to carry on so that Israel can have the land free of any Arab influence.
And back to the mission, I mean, what will the money be spent on explicitly?
Exactly. And well, at the moment, what we want to do is to buy a van and take that van to Gaza. We've got some things in UK that we can take, but there's a lot of high quality humanitarian goods that are waiting in Libya that can be loaded onto the vans and taken. So what we particularly want from Bristol people is for them to dig into their pockets again. They've done it many times with our earlier convoys, I know. We're hoping to raise 6,000 to buy a van, but not only will it take goods into Gaza, but also it will stay there, and obviously that's very much needed by the Palestinian people. New vehicles are really important to them.
What sort of connections do you think might be able to make with the West Bank? I mean, that's sort of the two situations between sort of Gaza and West Bank are different and commonly confused.
Yes, they are confused. But of course, one of the difficulties in setting up a Palestinian state is that they aren't contiguous pieces of land. It was difficult to pass from one from Gaza to West Bank because there's a passage to where you would have to go across Israel, and it's very difficult. And also, of course, at the moment, they're ruled by different political powers, Hamas in Gaza and the PLO in West Bank.
What sort of web presence have we got online, if people want to find out a little bit more information?
I know. If you want to find out more online, you can look at bglink.ning.com. That's the Britain Gaza Link website. But on it, there's a lot of information about the Bristol Gaza Link. And also, on this particular website, you can find directions about how to donate. You click on About, and then you click on Donate and follow the directions.
Okay, and what was that website once again?
The website is bglink.ning.com. It is an interactive website.
Dot ning.
Ning.com. But there are other ways that you can donate, and you can all do this as you're listening to your radio now. If you send a text to 84424 and send the word Viva, then automatically £3 will be donated to the convoy.
How extraordinary. How does that work?
Well, I think that it comes on your phone bill, but but it makes it really easy, so you can do that straight
away.
And
that number once again?
That is the telephone number 84424, and you send the letters Viva, V-I-V-A, it means life, and that's important for Palestinians.
And
if you send
pounds.
That's £3, yeah.
Good Lord. Well, Judith Brown, thank you very much for coming in, and maybe wish you the very best of luck. Hopefully we might hear from you on the way there, possibly by remote telephone super scientific devices. We'll be able to have you live on the telephone, and you can tell us about it when you get back as well.
Inshallah.
Excellent, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature is by Michaela Dennis. The Republic of Stokes Croft, of which some of you may have heard, is an incredibly vibrant and increasingly self-reliant community. And to document and celebrate this, a local woman, Katie Bauer, has set up a museum which she hopes will provide a place for people to find out about the culture and social history of Stokes Croft. In the first of a two-part interview, Michaela Dennis asks Katie where the idea of a museum for Stokes Croft came from and why it is so important. Katie also shows us around a few of the exhibits in the museum, in, of course, audio form.
I'm here in Stokes Croft Museum with Katie Bauer. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
And can you tell me what is it that you do?
Well, I'm mum and an artist, and I do work with the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the PRSC. I used to write a paper called The Stokes Croft Toff and Son, and now I've just created a little museum in Stokes Croft called Stokes Croft Museum.
And what inspired you to set up the museum?
Well, really, it's inspired by the ethos of the People's Republic, which is about a decentralised sort of self-rule, if you like, for communities, local looking at things communities need in a local way, not taking orders from top down, from people who don't understand what a community needs or what a community's like. They just have a kind of template of what people are like and what people need, and work that way. This community, having been neglected by government for a long time, was ripe for, had always sort of run itself, but in a very haphazard fashion, a very interesting fashion, and we think that that's precious. So we wanted to preserve it, if you like, and highlight it, because there are different ways of measuring success, and it would seem that the conventional way and the popular sort of globalized economic model is to measure it in terms of pounds and pence, big shiny shops. But unfortunately, those industries benefit. They do, of course, benefit people by employment, but the people who really benefit are very few. They're shareholders in big corporations. And we're interested in a different kind of economy. And it may not be that profitable on a balance sheet, but we feel it's more valuable. So it's not maybe as profitable, but it's more valuable that people somehow, with little help, most of the things that have happened in this area, fantastic things, are not funded. The Cube Cinema, which has a fantastic program of films every month, has been run for 12 years, pays full commercial rent, and has been run by volunteers for 12 years. No funding. The PRSC, which has been instrumental in turning this area into a cultural quarter that needs and warrants preserving, no funding. This museum, no funding. The Free Shop down the road, which is a charity shop that works like any other charity shop. You take your old stuff, but it's really a charity shop in that poor people can go there and take things for free. That is a squat, and it is run by volunteers, and it has, so it's illegal, if you like. So there, it brings into question all these things of what is legal and what is beneficial. We're interested in what is beneficial to a community, not necessarily what is legal.
Why in particular did you choose a museum? Why was that important?
Well, because you sort of play people at their own game in a way. People who do things like squat are considered an outsider minority. People are afraid of them. People don't like it. They see it as a very negative thing. We're not a squat. I pay the rent and the rates and things on this room where the museum is. So it's not about that, but it's about presenting what is here, things that are unusual to the more conventional people in society, in a way that they won't be so frightened of it, that they won't feel frightened of somebody who breaks into a building and opens it as a free shop for poor people. That's not a frightening thing, that's a wonderful thing. The building that they occupy was left empty by a speculator for 30 years. Now that's criminal. We think that should be illegal, that whole communities can be boarded up, creating a very depressing environment. It's about public space. Creating a depressing environment, that is actually legal. Opening it up and making a free shop is illegal. So basically what we wanted to do is make a happy, interesting, beautiful space which shows, it's a museum of the present and recent past, which shows the vibrancy and beautiful things that happen here in a positive light. And if you call something a museum, which it actually is, it is a museum, it's also a non-threatening, inclusive environment. We don't want to just appeal to anarchists and that sector of society who actually live here. We want to appeal to everybody. Anybody can enjoy this museum. And there's enough divide and rule that's gone on in this country, and we think it's time for people to stop being frightened of each other and start looking at the truth of the matter.
Tell me about your exhibition. What do you have on show in the museum? We're on a fantastic viewing platform of the whole museum, which is fantastic. Like, talk me through what you've got in the room.
As you can see, it's a tiny room because it's all like in the fall. It's rammed from ceiling to floor with exhibits. And from this little platform, you can see the whole thing. There's music, art, independence, which highlights People's Republic, graffiti, which is integral to Bristol culture, cinema, which is the Cube, rubbish, which is an issue here. People drive through Stokescroft and they think this place is just rubbish and that's what they see. But so, you know, I wanted to discuss that, for example. Shall I read you what it says? This was, I interviewed the street sweeper. I won't say his name because he'll get in trouble with CETA, who are his bosses. And it says here, I have to pick up and sweep both sides of Stokescroft, Ashley Road and City Road. Only 1 hour break all day. If people used the bins, I could sweep properly. The worst thing, but people throw litter right next to the bin. The worst thing is boredom and loneliness. If there were two of us, we'd do much more and a much better job of it. I've been doing this job for 9 years. I'm tired. So people are quite moved. Things you wouldn't think about, you just get irritated by rubbish. But when you see the workload somebody has, there's two things going on. Should not litter as much as they do, and realize that the margin set by highly profit-driven companies like CETA, the workload they put on people is unreasonable. So we think rubbish is significant. We've got clothes. I've got a T-shirt. Banksy used to do all his printing round the corner here at Screen One Printers, and that's one of the T-shirts he printed there.
How about addiction?
Well, addiction is a big problem here, because for all the beautiful things that happen behind these scruffy old doorways, there is obviously a lot of pain, very apparent when you come down here. People don't like it. They feel, I suppose, you know, it's repulsive. It's our society's failings, our human failing, frailty in your face, and it's an ugly sight and very sad. And there are a lot of hostels around here, so a lot of addicts. And I didn't know how to display it, and I didn't want anything grim in the museum because children like coming here and life's grim enough for them. So there's nothing grim in the museum, and people were saying, well, you know, you can get needles from the drug center, and somebody brought me an old crack pipe. I was like, oh no, I don't want that in the museum. So the museum, the addiction section, has a little embroidery that I made that says help. And then there's a quote from a local alcoholic. He's actually doing very well at the moment. He stopped drinking, but he nearly died. And he said to me, this is when he was still drunk, he said to me, when you wake up in the morning, you think you're having a heart attack, then you go and steal a couple of bottles of wine from Sainsbury's and you're all right. I used to drink in the streets when I was 13, but I only got into the really hard stuff, the white cider and drinking, as soon as I wake up, about 5 years ago. My wife left me and I fell apart. I was horrible, so it was my own fault. It's my fault that I drink. I want to stop for my 7-year-old daughter. She wants me to stop. I'm booked in to detox soon. Why do I drink? Loneliness. And that's Anthony Charles Pierce.
That was Michaela Dennis. Thank you to her, speaking to Katie Bauer at the newly opened Stokescroft Museum. The museum is 81 to 83 Stokescroft Road, just opposite the canteen. It's open 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Wednesdays, Thursdays and Fridays. On a Saturday, you can go in from 12 a.m. to 4 p.m. Entry fee is just £1 for an adult, and children can go in free. Katie is always looking for volunteers to help at the museum, so if you're interested, you can get hold of her at stokescroftmuseum@gmail.com. Look out for the second part of that interview, of course, where Michaela asks her what the local reaction to the museum has been, coming up on Dialect Radio shortly.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's time now for a feature by Alex Milne. Baroness Hayman, the Lord Speaker. She was in Bristol last week with Parliament Outreach, a group based in Parliament tasked with spreading awareness of the work, processes and relevance of the institution of Parliament, encouraging greater engagement between the public and the House of Commons and the House of Lords. Alex Milne spoke to her after she had addressed of local residents at the Black Development Agency in Russelltown Avenue.
I'm the Speaker of the House of Lords, so I represent the House of Lords and I chair debates, I preside over work in the House of Lords, and when I was elected to that position I had to give up any party politics because speakers in Parliament have to be completely impartial and independent.
And what was your background before you entered the House of Lords?
Oh, complicated. It takes a long time. I worked in the voluntary sector when I left university, Shelter, National Council for One Parent Families. Then in 1974, I was elected to Parliament and I was an MP for Welland and Hatfield for 5 years. I lost my seat in 1979. I then spent a long career break, bringing up my family, being a school governor, working in the health service, ending up chairing an NHS trust in London. And then I was appointed as a life peer to the House of Lords in 1996. In 1997, when the Labour government came in, the first Labour government, I was made a minister, and I was a minister for 4 years. Then I went back to the voluntary sector and I did the merger of the two big cancer research charities to form Cancer Research UK. Then this new job was created because previously the Lord Chancellor used to be the Speaker of the House of Lords. And when the Constitutional Reform Act changed that, created the Supreme Court, stopped him being sort of double-hatting, the House of Lords decided they wanted to elect their own speaker, so I stood with 7 other candidates and was lucky enough to be elected.
Can you tell me, why are you here in Bristol?
Well, I think all of us in Parliament, House of Commons, House of Lords, are, you know, have to have been concerned about the way in which Parliament is viewed, the loss of trust, the loss of an idea of connect between citizens and Parliament. That confusion, you know, that people slip into between government and Parliament. Government's the executive, the people who make the decisions. Parliament are the people who hold government to account, so that's very important. But the lady's just been talking in the discussion we had about civics teaching, about people understanding how Parliament works. So as well as the, you know, the bad things that happened in Parliament and all the concerns and the lack of trust over expenses and everything else, there's also, I think, been a generation who hasn't been told about the importance of Parliament, representation, how the individual can work through Parliament to change things, about how you change things in a democratic society, and indeed about our particular form of Parliament with two houses, the difference between the House of Lords, House of Commons. So that's all a long backdrop to saying that Parliament's putting quite a lot of resource now into outreach work and trying. We've got outreach officers in different parts of the country who try and connect with community groups, bring people like me down to talk. I've been Citizens Advice Bureau this morning, then talking to a group at a school, and then here this afternoon.
And what were these hot topics that came up in the discussion this afternoon?
I gave my little talk about what the House of Lords does and how we're not quite the stereotype of aristocratic old men in red robes sort of shuffling into the chamber, and how it's quite a diverse group of people now and how it's changed from that stereotype, and all the different sorts of people, different backgrounds, different ethnicities of people who are there, and what we do in that job of holding government to account and changing legislation, and how individuals, you know, some questions at the end about how policy can be influenced through individuals. We had quite an engaged debate about money, back to expenses, and there was a lot of challenge about the sort of money that was paid to people, going to be paid as an attendance allowance, because we don't have salaries in the House of Lords, and for going in on a daily basis. And I think the concern that I took away from it was not so much the resentment of people being supported as parliamentarians, because we don't want this to be the preserve just of the rich. You've got to be able to allow people, like the people I met today, if they want to volunteer and apply to be a member of the House of Lords, you've got to give them the financial wherewithal to do it. I think the concern was that society is depending on volunteers to do a huge amount of work, and they're not getting the right level of financial support to do that work.
Are you hoping to get more people to get involved in this sort of activity?
Well, we very much welcome visitors to the House of Lords. Schools are a prime area. Recently, we've got a new system where we can support the travelling expenses of schools, because predominantly schools who are near to London find it easy to come. Schools who are a long way away find it much more difficult. But we do now have parliamentary outreach officers, not just for schools, but for community groups based all around the country, so that they can do events like this locally, so that even if people don't actually come, the internet is a great leveller and makes distances shorter to show them how they can contact people, how they can find out what select committees are doing, inquiries, and give evidence to them, you know, without actually having to trog all the way down to London and try and see an individual.
Are there any schools in the Bristol area that are expressing an interest in going up to see how the system works?
Well, I'm sure there are. I went to one school today. I had a really good visit to St Mary Redcliffe and Temple School this morning, and interested children to talk to about Parliament and how it operates. One of the difficulties with Parliament is that it's such a historic building, and, you know, it's like one doesn't want it to be like visiting a museum. It is a fantastic historical building. On Friday, we'll all be in Westminster Hall when the Pope comes. And there's a millennium of history, and you can't not be engaged by it. But we are also a working parliament, and where day-to-day decisions about the voluntary sector and about housing and about employment and the things that affect people in their daily lives are being made. And, you know, it is a challenge to all those people working in the education service and the outreach service, both to transmit the history and the traditions, but also to do the up-to-date stuff about this is modern democratic politics.
Thank you very much to Alex Milne there, and he was talking to the Speaker of the House of Lords, Baroness Amon. He says he doesn't know much about history, but up next is a track by Sam Cooke called Wonderful World. And following that, we have someone who does know about history, an interview with the local historian Julian Lee Jones.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I love you, and I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. Don't know much about geography, don't know much trigonometry, don't know much about algebra, don't know what a sliding rule is for, but I do know what it was too. And if this one could be with you, what a wonderful world this would be. Now I don't claim to be an A student, but I'm trying to be, for maybe by being an A student, baby, I can win your love for me. Don't know much about history, don't know much biology, don't know much about a science book, don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I love you, and I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. La ta 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 ta.
And that was Sam Cooke and Wonderful World from his Greatest Hits selection. Now, continuing his ongoing series of interviews with local historian Julian Lee Jones, we are now going to hear more from Tony Gosling. Bristol has one of the richest heritages of a local history of any city in Europe, and in the 1980s, the Temple Local History Group began. Engineer, historian and author Julian Lee Jones is the author of the fascinating book Bristol Curiosities. Dialect's Tony Gosling continues his conversations with Julian about Bristol's hidden history.
My favourites in the book, out of the 25 chapters, one which I called A Mariner's Tale, which is one of the first ones in the book, and that is the story which I've read in many Bristol history books about how the merchant venturers' almshouses, the mariners' almshouses, the pink ones at the bottom of King Street, just by the Prince Street, what was the roundabout, there was a chap there called Llewellyn Penrose, and his sons got killed at Bunker Hill in the American Independence War. He told the story of his adventures to Edgar Allan Poe, who used the story in his story The Gold Beetle, about treasure, and the gold beetle was where, to actually find the spot where the treasure was buried, a string was lowered through an eye of a skull in a tree, and it went through, and the gold beetle, and this indicated where the treasure was underneath the tree. So I started looking into this, and when I actually got to do the sort of research, we found out that, I start off with, the chap's name wasn't Llewellyn Penrose. True, he lived in the mariners' almshouses. The real story was more fascinating than the fiction, the historical fiction. And his name was William Williams. He actually died 13 years before Edgar Allan Poe was born, which did make their conversation, other than by Ouija board, a bit difficult. But he sailed from Bristol as a mariner. He was shipwrecked on the Mosquito Coast in Costa Rica, on the Caribbean side of the isthmus. And the Mosquito Indians, M-O-S-K-I-T-O, nothing to do with the insect. He took up painting there, and after, I think it was about 2 years there, he was rescued by an American ship, ended up in Philadelphia, decided he'd had enough of the sea, and he took up painting, social painting, and he taught a chap called Benjamin West, who was a young Pennsylvanian, quite well-to-do family. Anyway, both he and Benjamin West at different times ended up back in England. He had a studio in Clare Street at one time, and he wrote an account of his adventures, and he told John Eagles. Mr. West became the president of the Royal Academy. And when William Williams was on hard times, he actually approached him as his patron. But the thing is, he wrote this story. Mr. Eagles, Captain Eagles, actually befriended him because he realised he wasn't your normal down-and-out mariner. He was very erudite, very well-read. He gave John Eagles and his family a copy of his journal, William, which he'd written under the pen name of William Penrose. And it was only after William Williams died, and they were going through his effects and something like 200 paintings and various other things, that they sat down and read this, and they realised what an amazing... And their son, the Reverend Eagles, was curate at St. Nicholas at one time, and he also knew the West family in London, and so it closed the loop, and they realised. But this chap, William Williams, far from being a down-out, he's got paintings in the national museums and art collections across America and other places. I've tracked down about three or four so far. And that is another example of how just doing a research like this. So this was original research that came purely out of the request to do this book. My other favourite chapter, which I put together, which was Bizarre Beliefs and Odd Occurrences. Again, you can't dream up the sort of zany things that people do. A lot of people in Bristol know about Dr. Beddoes, and, of course, one of his protégés lived in Rodney Place in Clifton, and one of his protégés was a Mr. Davy, Humphrey Davy, who ran the institute down in Dowry Square, the Pneumatic Institute. That's Humphrey Davy of the Minor Lamp and Nitrous Oxide Laughing Gas. Blair was looking at various gases and things, and one of Dr. Beddoes' particular beliefs was that TB could be cured by actually having a cow in the bedroom to breathe over the patients.
It's a bit impractical, though, isn't it?
Depends how big your bedroom is, I suppose. And but another theory he had, which is that young ladies suffered from TB, and it was due to an excessive drinking of green tea. And he wanted to carry out some experiments to prove or disprove this. Now, his experiments involved getting a pond, filling it with frogs and feeding them on green tea. I'm not quite sure there's this intellectual jump here which I've missed. Anyway, he ran out of frogs in Bristol, and he persuaded a friend in Shropshire to gather frogs for him, which he had shipped to Bristol in a hogshead. Now, the story at the time was that the story's quote, or the account's quote, that he had a big one of these hogshead, that's these huge big wooden barrels, like the tobacco you see in about sort of 5-6 foot high and about 3-foot, 4-foot diameter. One of these, and they were lowering this, and it had 10,000 frogs in it. And they were lowering, but the actual fact is that when they were lowering it onto the quayside, the rope broke, and the frogs all fell into the river. I think it's probably more like 300 or 400 rather than, or 1,000 maybe, rather than 10,000. Anyway, the frogs all fell into the river. I mean, some escaped. The ones that fell into the river probably died immediately, bearing in mind what the River Avon was like in the mid-19th century. Some were gathered up and were then later sacrificed by the doctor in cause of science.
Drowned in green tea.
Drowned in green tea. But the problem was that this is in the height of the Jacobin fears. And when people saw him taking all these frogs into his house in Rodney Place, they thought it was some plot, and they thought that he had French insurgents hiding in his cellars, and these were to feed them. And they were actually going to burn his house down. So anyway, it was sorted out, and somebody intervened on behalf, and sort of the amphibian melee. It was, if you actually look in Felix Farley's journal, it's recounted in there, but it never actually explained what they did with the pond of green tea, and the present owners of the house don't know anything. Maybe they had a soiree for the ladies of Clifton, but what I said in there was, you know, next time if you see a green, very green frog, maybe you should ask if it's one of the Shropshire frogs, you know.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Thank you very much to Tony Gosling and also to Julian Lee Jones there, reminding us how easy we seem to forget about our local heritage. More local history from Julian next week. Temple Local History Group's website is history4u, that's the number 4 and the letter U, history4u.info. Well, straight out of Swindon, our very own Malcolm Greaves, expert actor, will now read another instalment of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell.
Secrets and Lies. The last few drops squeezed from David Southwell. In his 1995 autobiography, Who Goes Home?, former Member of Parliament and Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, Roy Hattersley, unwittingly gave confirmation of one of the oldest and strongest rumours that does the rounds in the Houses of Parliament, that there is a hidden Masonic temple in the Palace of Westminster. The now Baron Hattersley recalled being mistaken for a Freemason by fellow Labour MP George Brown. Thinking Hattersley was about to leave the Houses of Parliament to attend a lodge meeting, George Brown told him, "You don't have to go outside. There is a special parliamentary lodge. Shall I get you transferred?" With two lodges of MPs and peers, and the gallery lodge, the Masonic lodge made up of journalists working in the Houses of Parliament, it is not surprising there is a temple for their use within the building. The fact that it is real has been confirmed to me both by non-MP Masons who have been shown it whilst visiting the Palace of Westminster, and by current MPs who have testified to its existence. The use of Masonic symbolism in the Palace of Westminster has long been established, from the chessboard floor of the debating chamber of the House of Commons, which has given us the famous phrase, "the floor of the House," to the precise symbolic measurements and Gothic design elements incorporated into the building when it was rebuilt by Charles Barry and Augustus Pugin, both noted Freemasons, after a fire in 1870. It now appears they also built a Masonic temple into the palace as well. The exact location of the temple within the Palace of Westminster is difficult to determine. There is a security presence, which makes exploring difficult. However, with almost 1,000 rooms, 100 staircases and more than 2 miles of passageways, there is more than enough space to accommodate it. As recently as the 1990s, several rooms which had been lost and unused for more than 70 years were rediscovered. It seems, however, that the temple continues to stay purposefully lost. In May 2000, Pope John Paul II prayed at the shrine of the Virgin Mary in Fatima, Portugal. Although the town is known for its once secret prophecy, it still has more tangible things to cover up. In 1942, the Catholic shrine there received £110, 49.9 kilograms, of gold ingots from Nazi Germany that were secretly held onto until, as the church admitted, they disappeared in 1970 to an unknown destination. The exact nature of the Vatican's relationship with the Nazi regime during the Second World War is one of its most closely guarded secrets. However, it is proven that the Nazi regime had close ties with the Vatican through its use of the Vatican Bank to assist in transferring illegally obtained SS gold to non-European accounts during the war. It is also known that the Vatican played a significant role in helping Nazi war criminals escape justice. Klaus Barbie, Adolf Eichmann, Heinrich Müller, Franz Stangl, and a raft of other Nazis were able to leave Europe for Latin America through what has become known as the Vatican Rat Line. Operated largely by a bishop named Alois Hudal, it is a matter of debate how much Pope Pius XII knew of the activities that helped members of the SS leave Italy with false identities and large amounts of cash. Given that the Pope gave Hudal a mission to visit German prisoner of war camps to find occupants worthy of special assistance from the Vatican, innocence is difficult to presume. It was not just German Nazi officials the Vatican helped. It sheltered Croatian Nazi collaborators, known as the Utashi, within Vatican properties after the war and helped them escape to Argentina, including their leader, Ante Pavelic. The Vatican Bank also helped launder $200 million, which Utashi leaders had stolen. While being hid, members of the Utashi met Pope Pius XII's acting Secretary of State, Giovanni Montini. The Vatican continues to refuse to reveal its papers relating to the rat line and the Nazi gold. Maybe some secrets are just too shocking for the faithful. Right now, somewhere in the developing world, there is a protest involving thousands of people against the International Monetary Fund. In 2004, there were 471 significant anti-IMF protests. As none of them involved major riots in a Western capital or major city, they weren't covered in the television news. Even when the reaction against the IMF causes major riots in the developed world, such as those in Seattle in 1999, it is often difficult to tell from the reporting what the protesters' beef is. The IMF claims it is an organisation of 184 countries working to foster global monetary cooperation, secure financial stability, facilitate international trade, promote high employment and sustainable economic growth, and reduce poverty. This sounds as sinister as a tea dance, and unworthy of so many protests. With North Korea and Cuba the only major states not participating in the IMF, it has a global reach and a mandate to provide assistance to countries that experience serious economic difficulties. In return for helping countries in crisis, the IMF demands that those they bail out introduce a range of economic reforms, known as conditionalities. These reforms usually include privatisation of state-owned assets and massive reductions in welfare payments to the poor of the country. Few countries on the edge of financial collapse can afford to reject the IMF's offer of conditional help. Over the years, the IMF has rejected criticism of the social problems its conditionalities have been shown to cause on the basis that the economic stability they create is worth it in the long run. However, in a series of leaked reports in 2003, it emerged that internally the IMF acknowledges that there is little evidence that its policies work. The reports show that those countries adopting the conditionalities often suffer a collapse in growth rates and significant financial crises. The reports also showed 47 of the world's poorest countries had become poorer after IMF intervention, and that the IMF distorted its claims of success by including countries it had not helped, such as China. Maybe the hidden truth explains why there are so many protests.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grease there for another excellent reading of David Southwell's Secrets and Lies. Thank you very much to David Southwell for letting us read it out. Well, and for writing it. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the studio one of our resident poets, Mr. Tim Burrows. Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good, yeah. And you?
Very well. Good. Fine spirits?
Yes, it's been not raining too much.
No, it's been pleasantly autumnal.
That's right, and melancholy.
Mm.
For poets. It's good for poets.
I see. What have you got for us?
Well, I've... Because it's been the Poetry Festival, I've been... This is so hot, it's still on my phone, which I sometimes use to write things. And I've been doing some reading about human origins and where we've been and where we come from and where we're going. So this is about where words were first used. So without... Because a poet without words wouldn't be much good, so I kind of thought about this. So I hope you like this. I, you, we, us. Linked by sounds... Words made to enable group hunting, root gathering, together, tied together by sounds created within the expanded brain to produce words, process words, remember words, as well as faces, landscapes, food, sources, safe sleeping places within the mobile group, the safety of the group, linked by need for food, for safety, linked by blood, by passion, by words, the end of the solitary, isolated I, the new we, linked by words.
Thank you very much, Tim Burrows.
Thank you.
And your delightfully, sort of pleasantly creaky leather jacket, adding a bit of ambiance, is excellent. It's just what we like. Good stuff. Oh, have you got anything to plug?
Well, I'm running a venue at the West Bristol Art Trail. That's 16th. When's the 16th? That's a few weeks away. So,
okay.
Yeah.
A few weeks away.
And I've got a surreal event in November on a boat in the harbour.
Excellent.
And the boat's going to take off at the end of the night and drift into the clouds.
Oh, brilliant.
But nobody knows that yet.
Okay. So you'll hear more about that and, well, the next time we have Tim Burrows on in a couple of weeks. Brilliant. No Jeff Sparks today, unfortunately. Everyone is allowed a holiday once in a while, or twice, in his case, because he's only here 1 week and then he's gone again. But we still have a What's On Guides, and he's given it to us, and here it is. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday the 1st of October, Wilco Johnson will be performing with support from the Soul Vents, which is spelled S-O-U-L Vents, which suggests they like to vent their soul, at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7pm, and the tickets are £12 if you buy them in advance, but £15 on the door. On Saturday 2nd of October, G, Baby I Love You, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol next to Muse, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm, and tickets are £8 in advance. And the Tunnels, by the way, is the new venue next to the Temple Meads train station. On to Song of the Week, and Jeff presents Ella Fitzgerald. She's been described as the first Lady of Song, and also Lady Ella, and had a recording career that lasted almost 60 years. This is from compilation album Forever Ella, and this is a track entitled I Only Have Eyes for You.
Stars out tonight. I don't know if it's cloudy or bright, 'cause I only have eyes for you, dear. The moon may be high, but I can't see a thing in the sky, 'cause I only have eyes for you. Garden or on a crowded avenue, you are here, so am I. Maybe millions of people go by, but they all disappear from view.
That was Ella Fitzgerald with I Only Have Eyes For You from the album Forever Ella. For more information, her website is ellafitzgerald.com. Recently, there was a change in management at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol, next to the Seven Stars, when members of the Blue Aeroplanes have become new management for this venue. So to celebrate, on Saturday the 2nd of October, they have Relaunch Night, featuring a headline performance by the Blue Aeroplanes themselves, with support from Yes Rebels, the Paris Rites, Davey Woodward, and also Amy Martin. Yes Rebels featuring the guitarist from Fortune Drive, who's very good. Doors open at 7pm, and the tickets are £10 in advance. And as I understand it, the newly launched venue of the Fleece and Firkin is going to focus more on local acts and less on tribute acts. Finally, on Sunday the 3rd of October, if you weren't exhausted by all the previous frivolities and gigs of the days before, Junip will be performing at the Thekla in the Grove, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £8.50 in advance. That's all from Jeff. Thank you very much for listening and have a great week. And he says, take care and goodbye. Also, just to recap, if you're interested in hip-hop and these things, KRS-One is performing very soon, early October. Grab your tickets for that because they will sell fast. And that's at the Motion Skate Park. And also MF Doom is performing at the Bristol Academy in the middle of October, around the 16th. Well, that's all from Dialect Radio this week. Thank you very much to our studio guest, Judith Brown. Not forgetting, if you're interested in the Bristol Gaza Link, stick that on the internet, look them up, and you can donate as well. If you text 84424 and text the word Viva, you will get £3 on your bill, but that £3 goes to the Bristol Gaza Link and the aid convoy. Hurrah! Features were by Michaela Dennis, Alec Mill and Tony Gosling, and thank you to Malcolm Greaves and David Southwell for the reading of the book Secrets and Lies. Tim Burrows gave us one of his poems, and Jess Parks wrote the What's On Guide. Studio engineering was courtesy of Lee Duffield and Michael Noyes, and the producer was Michaela Dennis. That's goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman. See you next week. Goodbye!